Blog Talk Radio.
Son of a bitch! What's up, people? Goddamn diggity. Hot diggity. Did anybody say that? Hot diggity damn? I feel like that was a thing in like 1923. Hot diggity damn! I got a long, great show for you guys today. We're going to kick it off with a story about corruption that's unbelievable. Well, actually, I say it's unbelievable, but we've covered so many stories on corruption that every story on corruption is now believable. It's amazing, man, what the government is up to and the sleazy tricks that they've now devised to get their agenda through, both the Republicans and the Democrats. It's grotesque. And our democracy, we already know that our democracy is gone, but it's going gone. I mean, this thing is nowhere to be seen, and they got to do something to address this trick, but they're not going to do it. Because they've done in the past, they've tried to do stuff to address these corruption tricks / not really, and it just made it worse. Like when remember when there was pork barrel spending, and then they decided to push it underground. They banned pork barrel spending, so it went underground. So before there was transparency about the corruption, and then there was no transparency, and still the corruption. We got something like that going on now. Ted Cruz also surprises me in terms of how he plays politics. See, Ted Cruz is a crazy person, but I thought that he had zero chance of winning because he's such a sleazeball and he's so far right on the political spectrum. But he's doing a very sneaky, intelligent, calculated political move that gives him a much better chance than he had. And I'm going to break that down for you in detail. And then later on in the show, we got Chris Christie yet again blowing the NSA and talking about how you must be spied on in order to keep you safe. That's not true, needless to say. Then The Guardian went into detail about all the different anti-abortion attacks from 1977 until 2014. And goddamn, it is a lot. I'm going to go through a whole bunch of the stuff with you here and give you the details as to what kind of attacks they were. Some of them were property damage. Other ones were threats, so they didn't actually follow through with it, but there was a threat, and then some were just out-and-out terrorism and murder and stuff like that. And then later on in the show, I don't know, trillion things. Penn and Teller are going to lead some Christmas thing, even though they're atheists, and not everybody's happy about that. And Marco Rubio wants you to know that it's cool. God is okay with 9/11, so don't worry about it. Yeah. A lot of stuff to get to. All right, let's kick it off here, and I want to do that with the story on corruption. And this one is gross. I feel like I need a shower every time I read the article on this. So it's time for Congress to pass another highway bill, and needless to say, the legislation ensures years of funding for our roads and bridges. So it's a must-pass bill. It comes up every few years, and it's just standard operating procedure. And that actually explains why it's now being bombarded with corrupt provisions. So Huffington Post reports on this. Congressional negotiators may include a controversial provision that would new mortgage rules. Negotiators are also discussing measures that would help a troubled for-profit college company avoid bankruptcy, as well as enable a bank to sidestep a requirement in the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial reform law. So this is a trick that's unfortunately been used a lot now in the past few years. You take a bill that's a must-pass bill. It's an absolute necessity. It's going to get through no matter what. And then you just start loading it up with a bunch of corrupt backwards provisions, which basically makes it so that you're the puppet to your corporate donors and you do their bidding. And there's something that gets under my skin about this more so than any other run-of-the-mill corrupt move, because it's almost like there's no way around it. They make it so that you can't go against it. Now, some people might say, well, if Obama had some balls, he would just veto it and tell them, this is still a must-pass bill, but now you guys are going to send it back to me without the bullshit in it. But would Obama do that? That's the question. And the answer, unfortunately, is no. He would not veto this. It would be a ballsy move for any president to veto this. But Obama wouldn't veto it for a plethora of reasons, and they ain't pretty. So Huffington Post continues here. The bank favor in the highway bill is for Emigrant Savings Bank of New York. The provision would enable the bank to circumvent Dodd-Frank rules against funding bank operations with excessive levels of borrowed money. Emigrant pushed its asset levels above $15 billion during the financial crisis, and Dodd-Frank has tighter rules on how much borrowed cash banks, with at least $15 billion can rely on to fund their operations. The bank has since dropped below $15 billion in total assets and wants to avoid having to raise more capital. Emigrant Bank Chairman Howard Milstein was a 2008 Obama bundler and has long been influential in New York politics. Oh, so do you see how that works? So since this guy was big for Obama in terms of donations, well, you know, if a bill happens to get to Obama's desk, which makes it so that this guy doesn't have to necessarily abide by the necessary provisions of Dodd-Frank, well, what are you going to do, man? It is what it is. I mean, I guess it's a must-pass bill. I got to sign it even though I'm basically gutting what remains of Dodd-Frank and making it so that the protections that were there to try to prevent another crash are totally gone. It's so sad. So when it's an Obama donor, they'll get the special treatment. Now, again, I could sense that there's going to be some people out there who say, well, how do you know he didn't do it yet, so what are you basing this off of? Well, I'm basing it off of previous action. So in 2014, for example, quote, lawmakers included a provision to subsidize risky derivatives trades in a bill to avoid a government shutdown. The ensuing fight over the swaps push-out provision nearly torpedoed the overall bill, which only survived after President Obama and J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon personally implored lawmakers to support it. I remember this because we covered the story at the time. It was in late 2014, and President Obama and the Democrats, to avert the government shutdown, they were like, okay, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to allow in some of the Republican bullshit, and, oh, you twisted our arms, I guess we have to subsidize derivatives if the shit hits the fan. Oh, what a horrible move that was. Now, again, they're doing it because they're paid by Wall Street and the corporations, but what that does is it basically guarantees another bailout if something happens with derivatives, and you mark my words, eventually something will happen with derivatives. That market is gigantic, and it's almost wholly unregulated, and it's casino capitalism 101. It's bets on top of bets along with side bets and puts and calls and all types of nonsense. And any gambler knows you gamble long enough, you're going to lose your money. Right back to square one here. And this is, unfortunately, Obama's legacy in this particular area. Oh, I did financial reform, pat me on the back. It was historic in nature. And then every year since then, slowly but surely, you chip away at that financial reform. You take these must-pass bills like the highway bill, and, oh, look at that, I just repealed part of Dodd-Frank in this bill. Oh, look, you need to avert a government shutdown? Well, I just happened to slip in a provision that makes it so we have to bail out slash subsidize the big banks when their derivatives trading goes bust. This is how politics in America functions. And we're not wrong when we say we're effectively an oligarchy now. You know, if you think we're a democracy, you better go back to your political science 101 textbook and read up, son. Because the democracy is supposed to function like a democracy, where if you're not talking about a constitutional issue, well, then it should be up to public opinion and the people and whatever you want, and you elect representatives who will carry out the will of the people. Now you don't get what you want ever. if you're middle class or poor, there's no correlation between what you want and what you end up getting in terms of policy. But there's a perfect correlation with the rich and the corporations, and it's a great example of it right here. Mr. Liberal Democrat Hope and Change himself is like, oh, yeah, I'll sign that bill that allows us to bail out derivatives. This is not what we elected you for, man, and he knows that. Okay. Now, putting that aside, we're going to move along to Ted Cruz here, and I'm going to tell you how perhaps, I have underestimated him. That's an interesting little premise to run with here. All right, here we go. So Ted Cruz made some comments to Bloomberg News that raised my eyebrows a little bit because he's using an interesting and unexpected political strategy. So when it comes to Ted Cruz, I've maintained for a very long time he's a smarmy asshole, which is obvious, but also that he's so insanely far right that his base is the few remaining Rush Limbaugh listeners in the country, the Mark Levin listeners, the Sean Hannity people. Like, that's his crowd. And that crowd, while they carry some sway in the Republican Party, is that going to be enough to bring a guy like Ted Cruz the nomination? No. And that's part of the reason why. The other reason why is that he's so fake that, you know, if you have any sense in your head, you could look at him and go, oh my God, the entire thing is an act. He's an actor. That's what he's doing. But I may have underestimated him because he's using a really interesting tactic that could be successful. So on the issue of foreign policy, he said the following, quote, Senator Rubio emphatically supported Hillary Clinton in toppling Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. I think that made no sense. Gaddafi was a bad man. He had a horrible human rights record. And yet, he had become a significant ally in fighting radical Islamic terrorism. The terrorist attack that occurred in Benghazi was a direct result of that massive foreign policy blunder. If you look at President Obama and Hillary Clinton, and for that matter, some of the more aggressive Washington neocons, they have consistently misperceived the threat of radical Islamic terrorism and have advanced military adventurism that has had the effect of benefiting radical Islamic terrorists. In Syria, arming the so-called moderate rebels, I think none of that makes any sense. In my view, we have no dog in the fight of the Syrian civil war. We are repeating the very same mistakes they made in Libya. They've demonstrated they've learned nothing. The enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend. If the Obama administration and the Washington neocons succeed in toppling Bashar Assad, Syria will be handed over to radical Islamic terrorists. ISIS will rule Syria. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking, what the fuck was that? Where'd that come from? That does not sound like something Ted Cruz would ever say. And you wouldn't be wrong, at this point at least, to assume Ted Cruz like a non-interventionist? Is he with Rand Paul? Wrong, that's not true. Hold on here. Bloomberg goes on to explain, quote, the Texan portrayed himself as a third way between the stalwart non-interventionist views of Senator Rand Paul and pro-interventionist policies. Oh, I see what he's doing here. That is a fascinating strategy for a Republican primary. And it might work. Now, again, I may have underestimated Ted Cruz because when you look at the polls, he's in the top four or so in most of the polls. So he's a sleeper. He's a sleeper. He's hanging back there. Now, the appeal of Trump and Ben Carson right now is that they are so anti-establishment in the tone that they strike and the things that they say, that people are like, anything that's not establishment right now, I will take. But historically, this is the time in the primary season where the people who don't win end up leading. Is it possible Trump wins? Yes, in fact, I think he is the front runner, not just on paper, but in reality, it's his race to lose. But there are people who are sleepers. I've said before, somebody like Marco Rubio is the establishment fallback. Granted, he's a classic politician, but when push comes to shove and the Republican base goes into the voting booth, what do they usually do? Well, with John McCain, they went with the establishment fallback. With Mitt Romney, they went with the establishment fallback. Marco Rubio may be that today. But I originally put Ted Cruz in the category of the Rick Santorums and the Mike Huckabees, where he's far too extreme and far too right-wing to get people in the base on his side. But when you come out and you make an argument like this, I think it's a fantastic political strategy to use in a Republican primary. So there is, a war hawk element that is the base of the Republican Party. But when you look at polls overall, for example, with Afghanistan, only 17% of the American people still wanted to be in there. It's a majority of Republicans who are like, okay, enough, I'm tapping out on that one too. Syria. Nobody in the U.S. wants to be involved in Syria. Nobody. I mean, again, we covered the polls on that. Something in the teens. So that's a majority of Republicans as well. So there's also a strong percentage of the base of the Republican Party that on this particular issue, they're not, hey, bomb everything and ask questions later. And perhaps they're not solely on the side of Rand Paul, where I would agree, where he's just like, look, only use violence for self-defense. So they're somewhere in the middle there, and here comes Ted Cruz with his, I'm somewhere in the middle on this too. And also, let's just note the contradiction in here. He's arguing for mild intervention / mild U.S. imperialism, where, oh, yeah, these places here, we should probably stay out, maybe, maybe not, because other comments he's made have hinted to the opposite of that. But where does that put him on the spectrum? That actually puts him directly with Hillary Clinton and President Obama. President Obama said in his State of the Union speeches, it's not a question of if America will lead the world, it's a question of how we lead the world, and he rebukes the stupid moves of the neocons where you literally ground invade in the Middle East and you occupy and you have hundreds of thousands of troops. Obama says, that's what I don't like. But hey, drone strikes nonstop, airstrikes nonstop, maybe some special forces. They're not boots on the ground, even though they're literally boots on the ground, but special forces here and there, advisors, military advisors here and there. There's your soft imperialism, your soft intervention, your middle ground. That's what Obama represents. And Ted Cruz, in classic Ted Cruz fashion, disregards that, and he says, no, I'm not with Hillary Clinton, I'm not with Obama, but I'm also not with the other Republicans who, like Marco Rubio, who seemingly wants to do even more intervention in terms of ground invade and high troop levels on the ground and stuff like that. I'm not with any of them. I'm my own man. I'm the middle ground, and that's why you should vote for me. I think it's a good strategy. Now, the only thing is, he runs into the brick wall a little bit of Donald Trump here, because Donald Trump always speaks off the cuff, and he's actually managed to say some reasonable things on foreign policy just because he's shooting from the hip. So, you know, in Syria, for example, he says, yeah, Vladimir Putin's bombing ISIS. So what? Let him. I like that. That's something I hear that. I'm like, that actually makes sense. Why should we have to fight everybody? Let Russia fight people. The Republican base also was like, yeah, why not? Now, that's not something you'd ever hear Jeb Bush say. That's not something you'd ever hear any of the other Republicans say. But Ted Cruz is showing maybe, you know, he's listening. He's like, okay, how can I find the political middle ground on this? And he may be a calculating politician who has a better shot than I originally said. And that's a very scary thing. Because with Ted Cruz, you get the sense that everything he says is an act. It's on the surface. And you have no clue what he would really do if elected. And my gut says what he would really do ain't pretty. Okay. Next. All right, now we go to Donald Trump. And this one could be a quick one here because the ad is quick. This is a Donald Trump ad, and this actually is going to suck for you guys listening to the live show because there's not much speaking in it, but I'll tell you what's going on. Donald Trump released a new ad attacking President Obama. and it basically mocks him and portrays him as weak. Showing ISIS shooting, and then Obama making faces, and then the Paris attacks, and then Obama smiling and playing around, and then the crashed Russian plane.
But good social media. Thanks, Obama.
That's such a sad ad. If anybody watches that and they're convinced by it, or they think, yeah, Obama, weak, that's an ape. You're talking to an ape. Obama, smiling. Joking around, ISIS exists. Bad. Like they juxtapose it as if like President Obama in the middle of a meeting about ISIS is making the faces and shit and joking around. I'm pretty sure when he's in those meetings he's listening, and he's being smart and trying his best to figure out what to do. But no, that's such a Trump ad. That's an ad that you would expect only from Trump. Because I could see him watching that going, we got him, we got him. Again, I keep bringing this up, but it's just like in the movie The Campaign with Will Ferrell, where they're showing the attack ads that they want to run against his opponent, who's Zach Galifianakis, and there's one that like literally accuses him of being an Al-Qaeda. I like that one. Run that one. That's good. That's a good one, right? And then I think he runs another ad where he like fucks his wife or something. That's what I feel like politics in the U.S. has gotten to that point in many respects. I mean, this is a classic example right here. That makes no sense. You could easily juxtapose George W. Bush fucking around and dancing and shit as you show shit happening in, you know, in Iraq at the time. And does that make sense? No, I could actually oppose George Bush based on the policies that he's pursuing. But what's Trump doing? Trump, you know, probably doesn't even know what the fuck we're doing, so he's like, I don't know, put together some ISIS footage and then throw Obama in there going, you got him, man, ha ha ha, you got him, okay, everybody vote Trump, Trump 2016. It's so silly. Now, I'll give you some facts here. According to the Department of Defense, quote, the U.S. has conducted 6,471 strikes in Iraq and Syria. 6,471. Those are the ISIS strikes. Why don't you show that footage? You know, why don't you show, because you can't, because it disproves your point, so you got to muck up some nonsense. And I'll show this chart here so you guys get some more specifics. It says, Operation Inherent Resolve. I can't stand the, like, nonsense names that they give this. It's a TV show or some shit. 129 tanks were damaged or destroyed. 356 Humvees. Staging areas, 676, buildings, 4,517. By the way, I'm just going to go on the record and say, this is not actually all good, okay? Like, a lot of this is bad, so let's just get that out there, too. Fighting positions, 4,942. Oil infrastructure, that's the one I think that should be targeted, 260. Other targets, 5,195. And look, man, that's the thing. Somebody like myself, who's a liberal, I look at this, and I think, no, it does make sense, since we've been fighting this so-called war on terror for over a decade, and empirically there are more terrorists, and we're not succeeding, it's made it worse, why not give somebody else a shot? You know, I think France is pretty angry, and they want to do something. How about let them give it a whack? How about, you know, Russia, who just had a plane that blew up because of an ISIS bomb, allegedly? All right, let them go at it. They're bombing in Syria right now as well. So let them have a whack at it. Let the Kurds who are fighting ISIS continue to fight ISIS. The Shia militias continue to fight ISIS. They want some humanitarian aid? Fine, we'll do it. They want some special forces for us to get top targets? Fine, I'll do that too. But yeah, you can let them lead it. So I look at this, I don't even like all this. But the bottom line is, this does contradict the nonsense that Trump is putting out in an ad. Look, Obama laughing and having a good time and ISIS exists. What do you want him to do? You want all day, you want him to sit there with your fucking face on? The mean mug? The resting grandpa mean face? That's the only way you'd take him seriously? And actually, you know what? The final point I want to make on this is, Trump has said before, kind of the same position I just articulated. In the debates, he said, yeah, let Putin bomb ISIS. Okay, so if anything, your attack ad should be going after Obama from the other position. Your attack ad should, I don't know, maybe cite the fact that 90% of our drone strikes have killed the wrong people? That's the thing about Republicans, man. They throw logic out the window every opportunity they get. Here you have an opportunity to say Obama's foreign policy is wrong for reasons X, Y, and Z, and make it substantive. You can say, hey, we're too involved, and we get too many civilians, and I would like to scale down. You could run that ad because you've said in the debates, maybe that is my position. But instead of doing a substantive ad, what do? The opposite. So I ask you, which is it, Don? In the debates, you say, yeah, let Russia bomb ISIS, and we'll scale down. Why do we need to be involved? But then you run the ads where you're basically going after Obama because you're positioning yourself to the right of it, and you're acting like he's weak and he's not doing anything on ISIS. It makes no sense in like 8 ways. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, Chris Christie is going to give his rah-rah NSA spying argument. And then later on, I'll give you more Ted Cruz and some Planned Parenthood attack numbers, which are unreal. I can't wait to go through the specifics on that with you. All right, stay right there, guys.
Break me, I'm hoping that it breaks me down. Son of a bitch!
All right, people. Let's keep it moving here. And we'll do that with Chris Christie. Short little clip says, oh, so much about him. Okay. Chris Christie is going to give his rah-rah NSA spying argument on Morning Joe. Let's listen.
For Ted Cruz's position and Rand Paul's position on collecting metadata made America less safe.
Yes.
Have I said it? So Ted Cruz has made America less safe.
Sure he has. He went for the easy political vote at a time when, you know, it looked like it was kind of a popular thing to do. With all those dead Parisians, it doesn't look so popular anymore.
First of all, you're already doing the spying, and it didn't prevent the terror attack. How about that? Basic logic. I know it's hard to wrap your mind around. And second of all, we already have a system that lets you spy when it makes sense to. It's called get a fucking warrant. And then thirdly, this is what people are mad about. Here are the abuses of the various surveillance agencies. UK intelligence classified journalists as terrorists so that they could spy on them and go through their personal stuff. The NSA spied on moderate Muslims as if they were terrorists. Now, there were some people who were, you know, Republican donors on the list who were spied on simply because they were Muslim. So they spied on all Muslims, moderate Muslims, because some Muslims did terrorism. There wasn't any intelligence work that went into it. It was broad, it was generalized, and I would argue it actually made it harder to find the real bad guys, because you're swimming in metadata as opposed to doing the hard work that investigators are actually supposed to do, where you get a warrant and you spy on the right people. They spied on porn habits to, quote, discredit radicalizers. So, hey, you're politically active, you're going against the grain, you disagree with the establishment, well, you might want to calm down a little bit and slow down there, because we know what you're searching for on the internet. We could just release that somehow. We could leak it to a news agency, and what are you going to do? I mean, take, for example, Elliot Spitzer. Oh, yeah, that wasn't weird how his information got out. They said, oh, no, we came across his stuff when we were doing an investigation on somebody else who was going to hookers, and we had his credit card number, and we just happened to stumble across Elliot Spitzer's information. So you memorized Elliot Spitzer's credit card number? And then you just happen to stumble across him when you were investigating somebody else. And then you leak the story. Whoops! No, I think it probably has something to do with the fact that he was called the Sheriff of Wall Street, and he went after them aggressively. So there's a way to kneecap him, leak embarrassing personal details, and yes, expose him as a hypocrite, because he was a hypocrite on the issue of prostitution. He cracked down legally on that while he was going to prostitutes. There's no defending that whatsoever. But make no mistake about it, they kneecapped him for other reasons, because he actually was the Sheriff of Wall Street. They spied on the Pope. I love that one. Candidate Obama before he was president. They spied on their love interests. It was so common that they had a name for it. It was called Love Int, short for Love Intelligence. That's how they'd refer to it. And it was just common. You know, hey, what are you doing? I'm going to go grab a sandwich. Great, I'm going to spy on my ex. This is part of the culture at the NSA. And it's more about power and control than security. That's what it comes down to. The government is never going to come and take your rights and announce, all right, we are now coming to take away your rights. That would be ridiculous. They'd never do that. What they do is they mask it by saying, oh, this is all about security and stopping terrorism, and if you're a patriot, you'll allow us to search all your personal information and collect your metadata and do all that stuff. You don't want to be unpatriotic, do you? And then this is how they come and take it. And then finally, let me say this. Another aspect of this conversation that drives me crazy is that we even need to have the conversation. Because let's say for a second, throw out all the facts that show what this is really about and that show that there's been widespread abuse in the NSA with all this stuff. Throw all that out and let's say for argument's sake, it was perfect. The program's perfect. Hey, we're able to prevent a terror attack. And all it took was us taking away everybody's liberty. Who was it that said, give me liberty or give me death? That's right. It's one of the founding fathers. And Chris Christie famously said, you can't enjoy your liberties in a coffin. So in other words, that's quite literally the opposite of what the founding fathers said. Chris Christie lamented, and I quote, civil liberties extremists. But that's the point, Chris. This isn't a two-sided thing. You either believe in civil liberties or you don't believe in civil liberties. If you throw them out when the going gets tough and when it's inconvenient, then you never really believed in your value system to begin with. The whole idea is that when the going gets tough, that's when you stick to them more. And that's when you prove that you really believe in these values and these principles. So, bottom line, this isn't debatable. And that's what gets under my skin, is that the whole point of the Constitution and the whole point of you having rights is that they are rights. They're supposed to be concrete. If they weren't rights, we wouldn't have called them rights. We would have called them permits. You have permission, derived from the word permission. We are giving you permission to have privacy, to say what you want. No, it's in the Constitution. It's called the Bill of Rights, which means that the government cannot take it away. They can't take it away. So that's the point. Even if the program did work, which it doesn't, you'd still have to say, hey, it is what it is. You know, this is our country. This is our government. This is the way the system works. You don't take away freedom of speech when it's inconvenient because somebody said something you don't like, and you don't take away people's privacy rights and protection from unreasonable search and seizure because you feel like it. You're not allowed to do that. That's the whole point of the system in the United States of America. So Chris Christie, ironically, as he accuses others of being un-American, he's acting un-American. All right, next. All right, here we go. Now we got to get into the abortion attack numbers. You ready for it? A lot of info is going to be thrown at your face right now. The Guardian has a very detailed article out giving the numbers on violence against abortion clinics, and they're pretty staggering. So according to the National Abortion Federation, between 1977 and 2014, there's been 9 murders at abortion clinics and 17 attempted murders. But they go on to explain there's other tactics as well. So things like property damage, for example. Quote, trespassing, vandalism, burglary, and stalking are recorded far more frequently. Since 1995, there have been a total of 5,147 violent incidents recorded at U.S. abortion clinics. They include 922 reported incidents of vandalism, 663 anthrax or bioterrorism threats, 354 stalking incidents, and 204 reported death threats. So they say, overall, the trends have actually declined since 2005. Now, there's been a slight uptick recently as a result of the release of those now debunked anti-Planned Parenthood right-wing hack videos, those smear videos. But overall, from 2005 until 2014, there was a decline. And to go through some of the worst incidents with you guys, March 10th, 1993, Dr. David Gunn of Pensacola, Florida, was shot and killed after being depicted in wanted posters by Operation Rescue, one of the most vehement anti-abortion groups out there. July 29th, 1994, Dr. John Britton and a court, James Barrett, were both shot to death outside another Florida clinic, which has been bombed twice, including in 2012. December 30th, 1994, two receptionists, Shannon Lowney and Leanne Nichols, were shot and killed in Brookline, Massachusetts, by an abortion foe who had previously attempted murder in Virginia. January 29, 1998, Robert Sanderson, a security guard at an abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, died when the clinic was bombed. October 23, 1998, Dr. Barnett Slepian was killed at his home in Amherst, New York, by a shooter with a high-powered rifle. May 1st, 2009, Dr. George Tiller, who provided late-term abortions, was shot and killed in the lobby of his church where he was serving as an usher. There's a gross irony there as well. November 27, 2015, two civilians and a police officer died during a five-hour siege in which a lone wolf assaulted patients and providers at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. Let me be clear here. The lone wolf is their words, not mine. So, for this far-right Christian terror, we need to push back in the battlefield of ideas. And in essence, this is the same thing that we always talk about when it comes to Islamic terror. And they got a laundry list as well. I mean, for example, I think in the past, what is it, month or so or 2 weeks, you've had attacks from Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda, ISIS. Nearly 1,000 people have died from jihadist terror in just the past few weeks. So we need to fight back in the battlefield of ideas on all of these fronts. And there's multiple ways to do that. So just to give one example here, as we spoke about last week, so in the case of ISIS, they talk about how we believe in the Quran is literally true and they have this fundamentalist Salafi interpretation. Okay, well, there are parts in the Quran that say intoxicants, drugs, are from Satan. They're from Satan. You are slapping Allah in the face if you dare to do intoxicants. So then why is it that virtually all of the ISIS fighters are taking Captagon pills, which are amphetamine pills, to use on the battlefield? Now, wait a second, guys. I thought you said that you believe in the Quran. This is Allah. Who are you to disagree with Almighty Allah if he commands something in the Holy Quran? So you're taking drugs, but Allah says that's from Satan and that's an abomination. I mean, look, according to your own belief system, kill yourself. Kill yourself. What are you waiting for, man? Again, I'm not coming up with my own thing. I'm saying let's use your ideology and, you know, compare and contrast here, and you're not actually following it, even though you say you want to follow it, and that's why you're doing this whole thing. Okay, be fucking consistent and kill yourself. Now, when it comes to these guys, there's an effective argument to use against them, too. So they're told repeatedly by their pastors and by right-wing commentators that abortion is murder and Planned Parenthood is selling baby parts for profits, and they're basically, like Bill O'Reilly said, they're the Democrats voted for infanticide. He's saying that the Democrats voted for infanticide, which is genocide. They're raised and brainwashed to believe that the left is in favor of genocide, and it's happening right in front of them. And, oh, my God, what are you going to do? You got to respond, right? I mean, this is crazy. How can you let this happen? And they make comparisons to the Holocaust and stuff like that. Okay, well, then let's fight them on their own battlefield, the same like we do with ISIS. Hey, jackasses, have you read the Bible? You do know that in the Bible, it's actually pro-abortion, right? So, as we've discussed time and time again, there's one part of the Bible where God goes through Samaria and he rips out the fetuses from the stomachs of the women. That would be abortion. That would be God literally performing abortion. Now, if that's not good enough for you, well, then there's another part of the Bible where they say, hey, if your wife cheats on you, she should have an abortion. So, wife cheats on the guy. The guy is supposed to give the wife something called bitter water, which is this poison potion. And she drinks it. If she miscarries, K.A. has an abortion, it's cool, it's cool. That was from the other dude that she cheated with. But if she drinks it and nothing happens and she ends up giving birth, well, then that's your kid and it's all gravy. So they're saying, hey, if your wife cheats on you, she should have an abortion. We are prescribing it. It's in the Bible. It's not me. I'm telling you what is in the Bible. Okay, so, hey, that's what you guys say you believe in. How about you stop listening to the jackasses who tell you what to believe because it's their interpretation of the Bible, and you go to it and you realize, oh, look at that. I guess I was wrong this entire time. You guys say you believe in the Bible, you think it's literally true, so I'm telling you what's actually in there. Killing these guys is a moral abomination, even according to your own book. Even according to your own book. So the most important thing, guys, we fight with facts because we're right. We're right and they're wrong. And furthermore, if you really want to have the broader conversation, let's have that one too. All of your holy books are embarrassingly incorrect. For fuck's sake, Mother Goose is more realistic. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe seems just about about as practical as the Quran and the Bible. Okay, so how about we educate ourselves and we're not dumbass bumpkins and we learn that we should act in this world in accordance with actual morality and not made-up backwards morality. I mean, these guys, as they say they're pro-life, they kill people. How do you... If you can't wrap your mind around the contradiction in that logic, all I have to say is good googly moogly. But if we keep talking about it and we keep hammering it home and we keep telling them how stupid and embarrassing they are, given enough time, you chip away and you win. Next, we go to Ted Cruz and his... So before we covered his good political side, now we go to his downside in terms of everything else ever. All right, I love this one. Let's go. So Ted Cruz sat down for an interview with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt, and they spoke about a variety of different things. For example, Ted Cruz blamed Democrats for crime in America. Stay classy. And then he went on to say this gem of a line about the Planned Parenthood terror attack. Quote, "I've probably done more than 100 anti-abortion events. I have never met, not once, a single pro-life activist who is in favor of violence of any sort." So let's look into that. First, I take you to the rhetoric of Ted Cruz. He's described Planned Parenthood as, quote, "a nationwide business of trafficking in the body, I'm sorry, a nationwide business of trafficking in the body parts of unborn children." Now, to be fair to Ted Cruz, he's not advocating for violence there. He's just saying things that are wildly incorrect and could lead really, really stupid slash crazy people to do violence. Now, there is a difference. You know, you can't, if some maniac decides to take something you say and extrapolate when you didn't really say the thing that they end up doing, that's, you're not to blame for that. You are to blame for the fact that this is factually incorrect and a stupid thing to say, but you're not inciting violence. So there's that. Now, let's continue here. How about the Army of God? Who the hell is that? Are we talking about some Muslim group here? Nope. This is a Christian group. They said, quote, "These murderous pigs at Planned Parenthood, baby killers, and they reap what they sow." Okay, that sounds to me like you're saying violence? A-OK by me. Now, this was just one activist at the group, so that's one. Can we really say that that's enough to pound the gavel and end a conversation? No, well, let's continue. How about Donald Spitz, who runs the Army of God and their website, referring to Scott Roeder, who murdered abortion provider George Tiller, and who Spitz calls a friend, he said, "How could that be counterproductive when he stopped them from providing abortions? They've lost their mind. Political correctness way too far." So that's crystal clear. He's saying, oh, come on, don't murder abortion providers. Don't be politically correct. What's wrong with you? That's the argument that this guy is making. Now, again, you could say, there are people inside the pro-life movement who advocate for violence and are cool with violence, but Ted Cruz said he never met with any of these people. So he's not wrong. He's saying he never met them. They may exist that advocate for violence, but he never met them, so his claim still stands. That takes us to somebody named Troy Newman. A week before the Planned Parenthood shooting, Cruz touted this guy's endorsement. So, buddy-buddy with him. What did he say? Quote, "When moms, dads, abortionists are added together, well over 100 million people bear personal blood guilt for at least one abortion. This responsibility rightly involves executing convicted murderers, including abortionists, for their crimes in order to expunge blood guilt from the land and the people. That is the clearest thing I've ever seen in my life, and I'll give you one more here. Kevin Swanson, who Ted Cruz did an event with just a few weeks ago, said this: Tiller killed 60,000 babies. So that's 60,000 dead babies and one dead abortionist. So let's just say the abortionists are still ahead on this one. It is interesting that if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Wasn't that what Jesus said? People tend to get their upcomings, and that's precisely what happened to Tiller the Killer. You know what this is, guys? This is a theme that we speak about all the time on the show, which is that Ted Cruz believes if you're on my team, if I've already decided you're a good guy, then you are a good guy by definition. So anything you do or say, put under the rug if it's inconvenient. So you get to go out there and say, nobody in the pro-life movement has ever said anything violent. Not that I know of. You just touted the endorsement of one guy and you did an event with the other guy a few weeks ago. And then many people in that movement advocate for violence. I'm not saying all conservatives are guilty. That would be ridiculous. The problem isn't conservatism. The problem is extreme conservatism, the far right, and particularly mixed in with evangelical Christian ideology, fundamentalist ideology as well. So, but Ted Cruz said, no, don't shh. Isn't it funny how these guys see the link between beliefs and action when it comes to jihadists, for example? And they're not wrong. You can point to verses in the Quran, okay, this leads, kill the infidel, and then they act on that, or kill apostates, and then you have some countries that literally have policy to kill apostates. They see the link between belief and action. Okay, so their interpretation of their religion there leads them to do violence. That's the problem. It's the ideology. It's the beliefs. When it comes to them and their side and their ideology and their beliefs, being anti-abortion, leading to the murder and the terrorism against abortion doctors and Planned Parenthood, beliefs, ideology, what do you mean? Don't talk about that, bro. No, we need to call it out in both cases. We need to call it out for jihadists. We need to call it out for fundamentalist Christians. And Ted Cruz here is playing the game of our side can never do anything wrong ever, because that would be inconvenient if I admit that they've ever done anything wrong. Okay. Let me take a break here, and then when I come back, I'm going to give you Bill O'Reilly's Planned Parenthood segment. Oh, boy. And then we got Brian Fisher, who has an interesting scapegoat. And then we get into Marco Rubio telling us what God thinks of 9/11. Stay classy. And hopefully I have time to get to Kobe Bryant, because Kobe Bryant is retiring, and he wrote a poem, admittedly kind of corny if you write a poem, to explain his retirement or announce his retirement. And I want to talk about that and then do some commentary on it, because I actually think there's some lessons in there, believe it or not. All right, so stay right there, guys. We'll be right back to cover that and much more.
I was told it was written, I'm an author, wanna go to the same place that the martyrs went, the black black figures on the wall in my apartment. Like with Damien, y'all, I be charging it. Touch it down with the people from my town. It's the shine that be giving me my ground. Dug in the crates of my soul and I found clarity.
Be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear. Come
yo,
on,
just be yourself.
We can be so clear.
So just be yourself,
y'all, be so clear.
Come on, just be yourself.
We can be so clear.
Just be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear.
Hey, yo, just be yourself.
We can be so clear.
So just be yourself,
y'all, be so clear.
Come on, just be yourself.
We can be so clear, clear.
Toiled in the trenches, faced judges on benches, betrayed by some that I fed, not to mention. Standing here now in the best condition. Out of the dirt, so I suggest you listen. See, money can't make you or me. Protect my mind with nines, cause it shines more than jewelry. Used to do things that weren't too productive. Now I breathe life into mics for your comfort. I see past the groupies and gold diggers to find women. How I'm living, doing me, and not savagely driven. Taught the game of fortune and fame. So I'm not playing no more, hold the torch for flames. I've lost and gained at the same time. MC and biting and swagger jacket still commit the same crime. Once you see past the purpose, that trash is worthless. With me, you get the last in purpose.
Be yourself, I'm gonna be so clear.
Come on, just be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear.
So just be yourself,
y'all, be so clear.
Come on, just be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear.
Just be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear.
Hey, yo, just be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear.
So just be yourself,
y'all, be so clear.
Come on, just be yourself,
I'm gonna be so clear.
Riley's response to this terror attack. Okay. If I can find the clip. There it is. All right, we're all set. Bill O'Reilly did a segment on the Planned Parenthood shooting, and he struck a different tone than he usually does.
Planned Parenthood officials are blaming the killings on harsh criticism directed at the organization after undercover videotapes exposed the sales of aborted baby body parts.
We've experienced so much hateful language, hateful speech. Such a negative environment has been created around the work that Planned Parenthood does, around the idea of safe and legal abortion. And we've seen that across the country from all sorts of speakers in the last few months.
Now, what Ms. Cower does not say is that Planned Parenthood is in the baby body parts business and deserves much of the harsh criticism directed toward it. Situations reminiscent of the assassination in 2009 of Dr. George Tiller, a late-term abortionist in Kansas. For $5,000, Tiller would terminate any pregnancy for any reason. He was nicknamed Tiller the Baby Killer by organizations who objected to his grisly practice. I reported extensively on Tiller, and after he was assassinated by a man named Scott Roeder, some far-left loons blamed me. The truth is, I reported accurately on Tiller, whose assistant was stripped of her medical license after the assassination. By the way, Roeder was given life in prison, a well-deserved sentence. Now, the big picture is the assassin Roeder and the Colorado killer represent their own sick selves.
Isn't that fascinating? So when the right does it, the individuals are to blame. But when it's jihadists, oh, Bill O'Reilly cannot wait to tell you the link between belief and action, the link between ideology and action. See, in O'Reilly's mind, with jihadists, you can make the connections. Okay, you could say, oh, they believe in killing people for apostasy, that's why they killed somebody for apostasy. And that's, by the way, you should be making that connection too, to be clear. They say they want to kill the infidels? Okay, look, they killed the infidels. But when it comes to this maniac who probably listened nonstop to right-wing commentators, but also to the various pastors talk about how abortion is murder, and we got to stop this, the left is committing genocide. Bill O'Reilly said recently, the left is committing, quote, infanticide. But in that case, no, you're not allowed to say that I said something that created an ideology and a belief system that would lead this monster to go do what he did. Now, let me be clear. I'm, of course, not saying that you blame people for saying things that lead to violence in this case, because he didn't say, it's only when it's a direct call for violence can you get outraged about it. So, like if Bill O'Reilly said, go kill the doctors in wherever it was, in Colorado Springs, their names are this, this, and this, and go, like, the direct threats of violence are unacceptable. But if you're just talking about, you know, generally speaking, oh, the left does X, Y, and Z, you're allowed to say that. So I'm not actually going after O'Reilly for that here and saying he's to blame for it. But see, I'm consistent in how I apply this standard. Bill O'Reilly is willing to take anything that anybody says when they disagree with him and say, you're directly linked to that action. But when he does it, when he's responsible for saying things like Tiller the baby killer repeatedly, and then somebody kills George Tiller, he's like, oh, come on, just blame the individual. Why are you dragging me? Why am I involved in this? I never did anything wrong in any way, shape, or form. Let me just refresh your memory real quick as to what Bill O'Reilly said.
Killing babies in America. That's the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. For $5,000, Tiller, the baby killer, as some call him, will perform a late-term abortion for just about any reason. You're okay with some woman being depressed, executing her child hours before it's born.
There's a lot of evidence there that he was performing illegal late-term abortions and covering up instances of child rape.
You should be very disturbed by what continues to happen in Kansas. This man, Dr. George Tiller, known as Tiller the Baby Killer, is performing late-term abortions without defining the specific medical reasons why. Tiller has killed thousands of late-term fetuses without explanation. No question, Dr. Tiller has blood on his hands.
Tiller the Baby Killer out in Kansas?
Acquitted.
Acquitted today of murdering babies. There's got to be a special place in hell for this guy. This guy will kill your baby for $5,000, any reason. Any reason. You go in, you go, the Glenn Beck program upset me today, and I can't have the baby. I mean, bang, you got $5,000. He's taking them out.
See, that's the thing, Bill. The reason why we're so opposed to you saying the stuff you say is that it's not true. I mean, with Dr. Tiller, he was acquitted. You called him a baby killer nonstop, and somebody went and killed him, but he was acquitted because he wasn't guilty of the shit that you said he was guilty of. Apparently, he wasn't acting in this wildly illegal, crazy way where he is killing babies. That would be absurd. It is illegal to kill babies. He wasn't doing that, or else he would have been put in jail. He was on trial, and they said not guilty. So our bone to pick with you is that you say things that are false. Just there, he said that Planned Parenthood deserves the criticism because they're in the baby body parts business. But that's not true. That's the problem. And then you're spreading these falsehoods, this misinformation, and then fringe crazy people end up acting on it. And the reality is, from those smear videos that were debunked, they claimed, oh yeah, Planned Parenthood is doing this to make money, when in reality, what were they doing? They were donating fetal tissue to researchers. The money that was discussed was only about transportation costs. That's it. They're only making money off baby parts. They're giving fetal tissue to researchers so they can, you know, cure diseases by using science. That wacky thing. But Bill O'Reilly goes out there and says, they're in the baby body parts business for profits. Why are you getting mad at me? Don't yell at me. I'm not responsible for anything negative here in any way, shape, or form. It's only the individuals responsible for it. Well, is that what you say when it's jihadists who do it? Again, that's not what you say when it's jihadists. When it's jihadists, you say there's a link between the ideology and the belief system and the action. But when a far right-wing Christian terrorist listens to right-wing commentators say, Tiller the baby killer repeatedly, and lie and say that abortion is murder and stuff like that, and when they listen to preachers say the same thing, and then they act on it, no, don't look at ideology, don't look at the belief system, don't look at any of it, it's only the individual's fault because I need to excuse myself right now of any responsibility whatsoever. And again, let me be clear. I'm not saying he's directly responsible. That would be ridiculous. What I'm saying is, Bill, you should say things that are factually accurate. And you don't do that. You're willing to make shit up about abortion because you don't like abortion. And in the process of making shit up, you do end up saying things that some fringe Looney Tune person can then use to kill somebody. Again, you're not to blame for it. But either way, for accuracy's sake, you should come with the facts, and if you don't come with the facts, which you never do, well, then you should lose your job, not because of, hey, you know, I'm against free speech, I'm 100% for free speech, but because you suck at your job, because you're not doing your job properly. Your job is to give facts, and instead you fearmonger and you make shit up about abortion, and you say crazy things. Okay. Now we go to Brian Fisher, whose response is probably even more precious. Fundamentalist Christian radio host Brian Fisher weighed in on the Planned Parenthood terror attacks, and he has a hilarious scapegoat.
And so they don't know which one of those things he said amounted to a specific motivation. So they're not saying, they're not even hazarding a guess. So we're going to have to wait for some days until we get more information about what might have driven this guy. But we do know that since he had moved to Colorado, he was a pot-smoking nutcase. And again, we've had stories. I mean, people laugh about this. When you're talking about people getting doped up or tanked up or high on pot and going off and doing brutal things. But we have seen one story after another where somebody will get, I mean, you have these edible forms of pot in Colorado, brownies and other kinds of things, you know, and they contain a kind of pot, kind of cannabis that is maybe five or six times more potent than anything that people smoked in college a generation ago. It's not the same pot. It's got a lot bigger kick. And people eat these edibles, it tastes good, they'll eat one, they don't get any effect of it, they don't feel it, so they have another one. Still don't get any effect, so they have a third one. And by the time they get done, they got so much of that stuff in their system that they get hopped up and they get hyped up. We had one guy killed his wife high on pot. Other guys are jumping off third floor balconies. So there's no question that the kind of pot that's available in Colorado today can drive you into psychotic episodes. So I'll be interested to see. Maybe this guy wasn't using anything that day, but I'm going to be interested to see what he had in his system, and if maybe this was a guy who was just tanked up on pot.
That was so shamelessly made up, every aspect of it. He's like, yeah, shooting at a Planned Parenthood? The guy said, no more baby parts? The guy handed out anti-Obama pamphlets? His ex-wife says that he's really religious and conservative? Gotta be the weed. Weed. Oh, yeah, you're so pathetic. You're so pathetic. Guys, again, this all goes back to I have to be the good guy by definition. So, okay, yeah. Shooting bad, murder bad. How do I work my way out of this? Blame the liberals somehow. Marijuana, weed, something. Just don't look at me. You don't see this on the left, man. You don't. Look, I'll do it right now. I'll be the first to admit. There are many people who, in the name of authoritarian, keyword, leftism, so some forms of communism, they kill people, and they did terrorism. And if I see somebody who does that, and they do it in the name of Marxism, I'll be like, that was done in the name of Marxism. You want to know why? Because I'm an adult. I can do that. But with Brian Fisher, he's like, oh, somebody whose ideology is on my end of the political spectrum and who agrees with me on abortion being horrible. Goddamn liberals and your marijuana. I got him. I got got him. No, you didn't. We see right through you. You're pathetic. What? For fuck's sake, man. Weed, of all the different drugs to, you know, that you're trying to pin this on, weed is the drug where, especially if you eat it, okay, because he's actually right that it is more powerful the way your body metabolizes it when you eat it. You know, this is going to be your response when you do edible marijuana or you smoke some marijuana. This is the rest of the day for you. You're just going to sit on your couch like that. You know, the old joke is you can eat some Cheetos, maybe some cookie dough ice cream, watch reruns of a shitty show, shitty sitcom that you like because you're high. And that's it. That's the day. If there, you know, that drug, the worst reaction you can have is just paranoia. But it's not paranoia like, I must lash out and punch people. It's paranoia like, oh, don't hit me. That's the kind of paranoia. That's like worst case scenario. Whereas, you know, if you talk about drugs like cocaine, maybe alcohol, you're much more likely to be violent on those drugs. What does he do? Classic Brian Fisher. Zero evidence, zero research. The story doesn't even make sense, but he's like, I'm not saying it's marijuana, but I'm going to speculate about how it's marijuana for a really long time here and only not even bring up the fact that he's anti-abortion. The shooting was out of Planned Parenthood. He said no more baby parts and the laundry list of things that point in the obvious direction of the kind of terror this was. Okay. Next. So Penn and Teller are hosting some sort of Christmas gathering or Christmas parade, and the host of The View debated whether or not they were comfortable with that because Penn and Teller are atheists.
Lone dissenter then, and the grumpy one. I didn't like it. I mean, I don't believe that the war on Christmas is really a war on Christmas. I think that's sort of a false narrative. But the bottom line is, it is commemorating the birth of Christ. Ergo,
brilliant
myth.
There's
so great myth. And so, why was that an atheist?
Well,
if that's a believing Christ myth.
Well, it has nothing. Being the judge of the Christmas parade has nothing to do with your religious beliefs. Has nothing to do with. Listen, I did the Halloween parade. I'm not gay. I did.
But listen.
It doesn't. Your joy for someone having a parade should not be something that keeps you from being part of it.
But
that's like saying that only Christians will go for Christmas. That's ridiculous.
But it was Christmas parade. Why are you
the Grand Marshal? Did you hear what she just
said?
Well, you out of your mind.
I don't like it.
Okay, I have a lot to say about this. All right, so first of all here, let's do a little thought experiment. Take atheist out of the equation and put in any other group of people and see how you'd respond to this. So they're debating, they're having a conversation about whether or not it's okay that the atheists are involved or leading this parade slash gathering whatever for Christmas. All right, let's do it with Jew. I don't know, guys. I don't know if I'm comfortable with a Jew leading this Christmas thing, being involved in this Christmas celebration. It just feels weird to me. It doesn't feel right. How would the world react? How would the U.S. react? Take a race of people. Asians. You know, an Asian person leading the Christmas thing? I don't know if I'm comfortable with that. Are you comfortable with that? Why is it when it's atheists, it's like everybody, because of our cultural context, we're just like, okay, it's a reasonable question. I mean, I guess atheists don't believe in Christmas, so what are you going to do? No, that's wrong. Your reaction should be the same when people talk about atheists. Now, understand, guys, I'm not big into tradition. I'm not big on holidays and stuff. So, you know, I wouldn't be one to probably end up going to a Christmas parade or a Christmas gathering or whatever the fuck it is. But that's not the point. The point is some do, because they like the fact that it's basically become more of a secular holiday than anything else because everybody celebrates it in the U.S. So to have conversations about whether or not maybe they should be excluded because they're atheists, that is a bigoted position. Just because you're used to it when it's against atheists doesn't make it all right. And it, you know what it is? It's casual little things like this that you don't pick up on if you're not paying attention. But if you stop and think about it for a second, you go, motherfucker, that was bigoted against atheists. And that's exactly what that is right there. Now, credit to be clear here, I think everybody on the panel, except that one, and I don't know her name, to be honest, but that one person was against it. Everybody else was on the right side of it. But just the fact that we even have to have the conversation is sad. And then further, I can't stand how much culture brainwashes people. I really can't. Because you get the sense, like, when whoever made the comment, it was like, but this is for celebrating Christmas, Christ's birthday. Hello, that's the issue here. No, but that's not true. It's fake. It's fake. You're celebrating Narnia. Do you not understand this? December 25th. But researchers say that if Jesus really existed, which that's up in the air, but there's some evidence to suggest he existed. He's mentioned in different, you know, whatever, texts. So they say he would have been born more like June-ish, not December. I don't know how they know that. Don't ask me. I'm not a scientist, but this is what I've read. By the way, he also would look like a Middle Eastern dude. You want to know why? He's Middle Eastern. He wouldn't look like, you know, some hippie person who just came out of a Grateful Dead concert. Sorry to burst your bubble there. But, and also, the date December 25th, that's actually taken because other gods in the region predating Jesus had that birthday, and they also have the same story, born to a virgin. You know, you go down the line here. So, for example, Horus, Osiris, Krishna, Zoroastra, Mithra, all these, and there's a list, Adonis, Hermes, all these different gods predated Jesus, were born on December 25th to a virgin. And then now, people actually believe today in America, because they're not researched on this shit, Mommy and Daddy told me that Jesus was born December 25th, and that we're celebrating his birthday, so I believe it. But that's not true, and you're intellectually embarrassing when you think that's true, and then you're just willing to smugly dismiss atheists in a bigoted way. They shouldn't celebrate our nonsense with us. We shouldn't even allow them in because they don't believe exactly like we do. And finally, let me just say, dude, even the tree was stolen from a pagan tradition. That's a pagan nature worship. Tree, nature. That's what it was taken from. They said, let's incorporate this because at the time, I guess, more people were pagan in their beliefs. Okay, so how can we bridge the gap here and get more people to be Christian? Put a tree in your house for Christmas, which is Jesus' birthday on, like, say, December 25th. Which also happens to, I think, coincide with the solstice, too. How do you not see this? It's all fake. Your religion is fake. Wake the fuck up. And along the path here of waking up, stop being a douche to atheists. All right, next. Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio was at a campaign event in Iowa, and he made some hideous comments about terrorism and God. So he said the following, quote, "We are biblically ordered to not be afraid. You know why? Because God is telling us that no matter what happens, it is part of my plan. I will give you the strength to endure it, whether you like it or not." Where was God on 9/11? Uh-oh. Where was God in Paris? Where God always is, on the throne in heaven. The question was, how could God allow these bad things to happen? It always challenges us to understand that God's ways are not our ways. What we may interpret as bad, and most certainly is in the case of Paris or 9/11, even that is part of a broader plan for the universe and for our lives that we are just not going to know the answer to. God's ways are not our ways. Oh, boy. The Lord works in mysterious ways, so yes, he did 9/11. He sat by and let it happen, but you can't criticize it because God was responsible, so, you know, his ways are not our ways. What are you going to do? There's a plan. There was a plan to your son or your daughter or your dad dying in 9/11. Don't worry about it. How grotesque is that? How abhorrent is that? And how intellectually embarrassing is that? How can any guys, it's 2015? I can't anymore. And think about the way the logic works. It's funny to call it logic with God, where so if something bad happens, www.shh.com. If something good happens, all praise be to the Lord. Everything good is because of him. Yeah, but wait, when something bad happened, you just told me to shh. And you said, don't criticize God. He works in mysterious ways. So he's responsible for everything. He gives you insanely fucked up things and sometimes some good things. But he only gets credit for the good things, and the bad things you just get to write off. Don't look God fucked up, but don't say anything because he works in mysterious ways. So shut the fuck up. What a gig he has. Always get the praise, never get the blame, even though, like Marco said, he's responsible for everything. He has a plan for everything. Really? What's the plan behind leukemia? You know, how about, I don't know, natural disasters? How about earthquakes? How about droughts? How about famine? How about extreme poverty? How about war? You know, go talk to the people in South Sudan. Go talk to the people in the Congo who are getting slaughtered. The world is in chaos and turmoil. And he's like, it's cool, God's got this, but you can't talk about the bad stuff. Shh, the good stuff, give him credit for that. How does anybody believe this? How does anybody believe this? Guys, it's not true. Your myths are not true. And I love how they assert this, and then they call atheists the arrogant ones. Oh, look at these atheists, think they know everything. Everybody knows that God really is responsible for everything, and he had a plan for 9/11, and it's totally cool, and you give God credit for all the good things, but you write off the bad things and act like he didn't do them, even though I just said he did them. And we understand everything about the way the world works, and religion is true, and there was a talking snake and a bush, and the world is flat in the Bible, and there's all types of primitive nonsense there, but it's all true. I know all of that stuff, but aren't the atheists arrogant because they're the ones who claim to know stuff? You just claim you know everything! Get the fuck out of here, man! Here, I'm gonna surprise a lot of ignorant people here now. You ready for this? Most atheists are, in fact, agnostic atheists. Well, goodness, Kyle, what does that mean? I'm glad you asked. Let me explain. Agnostic is, so there's two different questions, what you know and what you believe. In terms of what I believe, I don't believe there's a God, so I live my life as if there's no God. In that sense, I'm an atheist. In terms of what I know, of course I don't know. I don't have powers that any other human doesn't have. So I don't know. Do I know if there's a God? No, I don't. That's honesty. In that sense, I'm an agnostic. So yes, my total position is agnostic atheism. It is the only intellectually honest position because you don't fucking know, even if you say you do. I don't give a fuck how religious you are. Perhaps you're brainwashed, but you don't know. You might believe X, Y, or Z, but you don't know. So we're the intellectually honest ones. And hilariously, we get derided as the know-it-all arrogant atheists. Right. We're the know-it-all arrogant ones when it's you guys who, you know, have to believe, in the case of Christianity, that a guy gave birth to himself. He's three people, but he's one person. Don't know how the fuck that works. The virgin birth. The talking snake, the Noah with the ark and the fucking thing, and, you know, God's going to come back and kill virtually everybody. But he's a loving God, even though he kills everybody. And then eventually we all go to heaven and party with Elvis and Marilyn Monroe. And in the case of Islam, for example, Muhammad flies back on a winged donkey. But atheists are arrogant because they say they know everything. But I know he flies back on a winged donkey. No, you guys are the arrogant ones. You guys are the ones that pretend to know shit that you don't know. We're the honest ones. Stories like this should sway you immediately as to who's being honest and telling the truth and who's not. All right, next. I got to do the Kobe story, so I'm going to do it. I'll save the Pope Francis one for tomorrow. I might get cut off here, but so what, it is what it is. Kobe Bryant announced that this will be his last season in the NBA. He's retiring after 20 years in the league. That's a really, really long time, especially at the position of shooting guard, where he has to move a lot and move fast, not like a center where sometimes you just kind of stand there and you're a giant thing in the middle of the court. So that's a super long time. And he shared the news in the form of a poem, which is a little weird and kind of corny, but I want to give you it and then say a few words about it. Bear with him slash me as I go through it here, because there's something interesting and important to talk about at the end here. So he says the following. Dear basketball, from the moment I started rolling my dad's tube socks and shooting imaginary game-winning shots in the Great Western Forum, I knew one thing was real. I fell in love with you, a love so deep I gave you my all, from my mind and body to my spirit and soul. As a six-year-old boy deeply in love with you, I never saw the end of the tunnel. I only saw myself running out of one. And so I ran. I ran up and down every court, after every loose ball for you. You asked for my hustle, I gave you my heart, because it came with so much more. I played through the sweat and hurt, not because challenge called me, but because you called me. I did everything for you, because that's what you do. But when someone makes you feel as alive as you've made me feel, you gave a six-year-old boy his Laker dream, and I'll always love you for it, but I can't love you obsessively for much longer. This season is all I have left to give. My heart can take the pounding, my mind can handle the grind, but my body knows it's time to say goodbye. And that's okay. I'm ready to let you go. I want you to know now, so we both can savor every moment we have left together, the good and the bad. We have given each other all that we have, and we both know no matter what I do next, I'll always be that kid with the rolled up socks, garbage can in the corner, 5 seconds left on the clock, ball in my hands, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then it says, love you always, Kobe. Now, again, I know, a little cheesy, a little corny, okay, especially people who don't watch the NBA, haven't followed Kobe's career, all that stuff. You listen and you're like, funny, right? And there's even, you know, mock poems that have come out where it's like his teammates today writing to him where they're like, you suck, boo, go away now. Okay, it's, you know, free country, everybody joke around, have fun with it. I'm biased because I was born in 88. I was, you know, started to follow NBA seriously right when Kobe came into the league and took over and was just a basketball god for basically my entire life. And it feels like, honestly, the consistent things in my life, the sun rising, Kobe dropping at least 20 every game, and Tiger Woods winning in golf. Okay, so I have kind of a weird emotional connection to it. And yeah, I'm sad when I hear him retiring. Allen Iverson's been gone for a while. Tracy McGrady's been gone for a while. Kobe Bryant is now leaving. The era is, like, totally over, and that's a little depressing to somebody like me. But I want to explain to you real quick just the kind of desire and passion that Kobe had for the game. So here's some examples of his work ethic. He decided to lose 16 pounds for the Olympics in 2012. He was already, you know, he wasn't fat to begin with. He decided, I'm going to lose 16 pounds in 2012. He showed up at 5 a.m. and left practice at 7 p.m. in high school. He'd make high school teammates play one-on-one to 100 with him. He used to practice by himself without a ball. He counts all of his made shots every practice and stops at 400. He did intense workouts, some people say up to 4 hours a day, on game day. He had Nike shave a few millimeters off of his shoes in 2008 to gain a hundredth of a second better reaction time. He ices his knees for 20 minutes, three times per day. He was doing that in order to continue to be able to play. And he watches film of himself at halftime. I tell you all that not to just show you, okay, Herculean effort, he loves the game so much, it's ridiculous, he's got passion and drive for this, so on and so forth. No, I tell you that to raise a question to you. What do you love in your life this much? Do you love anything in your life this much? I would say if you don't, you're probably missing out. Because this is what it's all about, man. You know, I'm not a religious person by any stretch of the imagination, but I do have my own goofy life philosophy. And I actually have a name for it, too, which is even more sad and pathetic. I call it passionism, which is the idea that you should have at least one thing, but probably multiple things, that you're so insanely in love with that you're happy to do this kind of work to achieve the goals associated with said thing. And understand your time on this earth is limited. I would guess that we're not going anywhere when we die. It's lights off. I don't know. I could be wrong, but that's my educated guess on the topic. So since you're only conscious once, why not take advantage of that and live life to the fullest? And in my opinion, the best way to do that is exactly the kind of way that somebody like Kobe showed for basketball. Have that kind of passion for one thing or multiple things in your life where you give your all to it, and then you get this successful, happy, fruitful feeling knowing that you did everything in at least that realm to the fullest. And there's actually a lot of wisdom in that. And I think it's something that not many people do, but if they did do it, they would be a lot happier. So, Kobe, thank you for all the years of being an absolute beast on the basketball court. I'm sure you'll be successful anywhere you go from here, but you're going to go down as a legend in the game because of your passion and your drive and your hard work in this field, and that's something I remember and I'll always take with me, and I think other people would do well if they did the same thing. All right, guys, I'm out of time, but I love you, and I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.